The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Today's episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. Stay tuned for the Ultra Player of the Week coming up later in the episode. All right, everyone, welcome on to Hollinger and Duncan. If you're joining us on Locker Room, we're going to do the pod for about an hour, and then we'll take some speaker requests at the end, so you can throw those in now if you want. They'll be answered in the order in which they've been received. Man, I mean, what a week it's been since that incredible Dame Lillard performance. Oh, wait, that was last night?
Yeah, exactly. quite a morning here. Man.
Well, so we haven't talked at all. I haven't had a chance to read anything that you've written, if anything, on this upheaval in the Boston coaching and front office. But what were your initial thoughts when you heard that news?
So I've been hearing stuff about the Ainge part for several weeks. So that part didn't shock me that much. The part that really shocked me was that they were moving Stevens up. One, because he's one of the best coaches, right? So now you create a vacancy there. And then two, obviously he's never worked in the front office before. So there's presumably going to be a learning curve there for him. Not to say that he can't do it, but he's definitely unproven in that capacity, certainly. So that was a big surprise on that front. And it really begs the question of where is Boston heading and what is their financial capability in the next couple seasons? Because you wonder if one of the reasons that both do something else because what is ownership's commitment level to salary tax next year with this team? Because if they're not willing to go $15 million over, they're not going to have much of a team, right? It's going to be Tatum and Brown and not much else. So I wonder how much that played into both of those decisions.
Yeah, and I know there's some reporting as well about Ainge being really, really close to Ryan Smith, and perhaps Ainge being from Utah, all the connections that he has to that state, that maybe speculating that there could be something there as well. The other thing that really surprised me about it, because I woke up, I was up late last night recording after that crazy game, and so I didn't wake up until about like an hour ago. So I was sort of like scrolling back through reading it, and I'm like, man, yeah.
So it's like a regular day for you.
No, I got up about a half hour later, actually, than I normally do. Okay. I mean, is 9:30 a ridiculous time to get up for someone with no children? I'm on the West Coast. Like, it annoys me because, like, when people on the East Coast have, like, some sort of business they want to conduct with me, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm available after 12:30 your time. And I think they're like, they probably think I'm, like, really lazy. I'm like, dude, I work until, like, midnight every night. Like, give me a break, man. I'm not going to go to bed immediately the moment I'm done. All right. Anyway, the thing that was surprising to me.
He's done this rant before.
The surprise to me is, like, why is it so important that if Brad Stevens doesn't want to be the coach anymore, that, like, he has to stay in the organization as an executive? Like, where is the evidence that he's a good executive? Particularly, I think also, if I were Austin Ainge or Mike Zarin, and maybe, who knows, maybe Austin Ainge will go wherever Danny Ainge goes next, if Danny Ainge does go somewhere next as well. But they have people in the organization that have been there forever that are very well respected, and to just have Brad Stevens all of a sudden be elevated above them is a little interesting to me.
I agree with that.
Maybe that's why they feel that Brad, is just a really good people person and kind of, overall executive, and maybe he won't be as involved in some of the day-to-day, like, salary cap type of stuff. And, it's easier to do this with Brad Stevens when you have that experienced staff in place of people who have been there for a long time. But it's also it's a little bit weird. And I guess there's like, you know, Brad is just so awesome, we gotta keep him in the organization, and he probably obviously has a great relationship with ownership if they want him to do this. But it does, like, why is Brad qualified for this? I don't really understand that. And that's, I think that's something that I'll, you know, this is yet another, now people have made the transition obviously, but that was a long time ago when the job was required far less specialized knowledge.
I mean, Lawrence Frank made the transition more recently, and the thing here I think that is key is that he's not trying to be the coach at the same time, because everyone who has tried to do the coach and the president job at the same time, with the exception of Greg Popovich, has basically been their own worst enemy.
Yeah.
And so I do think that part is helpful. So, I mean, they may have, you know, trying to see the glass half full here. I mean, between his people skills and his knowledge of basketball, I mean, they may have decided that, you know, he had those capabilities, and you can get the other stuff in other places, and indeed already had most of the other stuff already on their staff. So the interesting part to me is that, you know, this also requires a certain sense of being a poker player to me. And we just don't know anything about Stevens on that front.
Yeah, I think he can be pretty good at that. I think he's hopefully someone who, I guess what's going to be funny is we're going to find out which players on his roster Brad Stevens thought was good when he was the coach. Other than the evidence of who he played, obviously, too.
Yeah.
But
Jeff Teague, 4 years, $50 million.
But also, as an aside, how dare you say that Lawrence Frank had no front office experience after the incredible jobs that he did writing reports for Jason Kidd
in How dare I overlook that formative experience?
So I think one of the biggest points that you made that I want to get back to is this idea that what their roster looks like and how much they are really kind of coming into a crunch now, and that maybe there is an idea that there might have to be some kind of a retrenchment. To me, Kemba Walker, obviously at $36 million for next year, is a big target there. And perhaps there is a team that might be looking to get him and offload some of their bad salary, but that seems to be like, maybe they'll even would pay a little bit to get off of that. And if you can move him and take back, you know, either moving him into a team's cap space, or, you know, take back $20 million in salaries or so instead, then you're probably in better shape to re-sign Fournier and go forward with this type of group. Even if, again, you're looking at, or they could try to get off of Tristan Thompson at $9.7 million as well. That's another option.
That does a little bit for you, but it's Kemba's deal that's really the stick in the mud here. And that's going to be a tough one to move off of. I mean, it's $74 million over the next 2 years. He has a player option, but surely he's picking it up. That's just a tough contract to dig yourself out of. I mean, can you at least do a deal to trade him for a $25 million guy? I mean, I when I wrote about it last week, I float Kemba for Horford, I should say. So props to him. Without moving off of that contract, their hands are so tied.
Yeah, because they are at the tax line with 12 players and their draft picks, without even trying to bring back Evan Fournier,
They're six over. I mean, it's not even like they're at the, I mean, they're into it already. And if you pay Fournier anything or do anything mid-level, I mean, you're talking about a big check at that point.
No, it's and for a team that isn't necessarily going to be back in contention. And so, you know, it would be nice if they could get a trade exception and kind of go into next year the way they went into this year. It's pretty clear to me that this was not Danny Ainge's finest hour this season. I think he has had a wonderful tenure overall, but really kind of botching the Gordon Hayward situation, playing poker with Mark Bartlestein that Hayward would come back for the contract that they wanted, not accepting the sign and trade from Indiana.
That to me was a big mistake, and then the Thompson contract kind of double down on it.
Yeah. So I guess it's just going to be fascinating to see where they go, who they're going to bring in as a coach as well. I think that that will be very interesting to see. And also whether, whether the remaining people in the front office, whether they're all going to stick around. That's definitely an interesting thing to watch as well here. Anything else on this, or shall we discuss everything else?
Let's discuss everything else.
So we spent a lot of time discussing the Boston Celtics situation, John, and that means that it would only be appropriate for one Brad Stevens to be the Michelob Ultra President of Basketball Operations of the Week. Brad Stevens clearly was not having enough Michelob Ultra because he was not enjoying being a coach anymore. However, he believes that he will experience joy, happiness, enjoyment as the Boston Celtics President of Basketball Operations. It's only worth it if you enjoy it, and at only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, you will enjoy Michelob Ultra. Enjoyment isn't the end game, it's the whole game. I know that many of our listeners are just kind of starting out in life. If you're buying a home, you're trying to build some wealth, starting a family. So be sure to add securing your family's future to your to-do list by establishing a will or a trust at trustandwill.com. You can set up your estate plan using their simple, convenient, and secure interface for as little as $39. You can nominate guardians for your children, determine who gets your stuff, and plan for future medical care, all from the comfort of your home. Using a one-size-fits-all template, that's not what Trust and Will is about. Their documents are designed by estate planning experts and customized for the state that you live in. They've got live customer support 7 days a week. So if you're doing this on the weekend, you can still get some support. They can answer any questions you have while setting up your plan. For me, it's not really something I thought that much about. A global pandemic has a way of kind of changing your thinking in some ways. So I encourage you to give it a try to Trust and Will. Get some peace of mind at trustandwill.com/PER. That's trustandwill.com/PER. You can get 10% off plus free shipping of your customized legal documents. Don't wait. Go right now to get 10% off plus free shipping at trustandwill.com/PER. Easy to remember, /PER, because John invented it. That's trustandwill.com/PER. So where do you want to start? What else has been on your mind here?
Can we talk about Joel Embiid?
Yeah, I had a feeling once it came out yesterday that they were going to like do more testing, and they didn't announce what it was, that it was going to be something along these lines, which I guess is the least worst news that it could be after finding out that he had this injury, that it's something that he's going to like try to play on. A small lateral meniscus tear is what's been reported, but I don't know. It's rough for Embiid. He can never be healthy at the time they need to. And the 1 year that he was, Ben Simmons wasn't healthy. So it's a pretty big problem for Philly, obviously. But do you think there's a chance he can get back to being healthy?
To being like healthy, yes, in this playoffs? So there's an interesting thread from Jeff Stotts from In Street Clothes today, basically mentioning the fact that Andrew Bynum played through an injury like this in the 2010 playoffs.
And not well, if memory serves.
And then the aftermath of that didn't go that great either. So it's maybe not the greatest omen, but it's something. Depending on how small the tear is and the location, that it might be plausible for him to come back and play on it. But when you're dealing with somebody who's already as fragile as Embiid, like how badly do you want to risk this if you're Philly and if you're Embiid for that matter?
Particularly, the Supermax on the horizon here for him that he could sign this offseason, right? Yeah, he can. Yeah.
He could. Wow. Yeah, you're right. I was looking at him still having 2 years left, but yeah, you can do that now. So he could, yeah. And that obviously would be if I'm him, that's the right play to just lock in, you know, that kind of security as soon as you can.
Yeah.
This to me is a decision that goes beyond just the trainer giving a green light to say he can play or he can't. This is a franchise level decision that you need management and ownership all on the same page on what the risk reward is, and you know, being really clear about what the potential outcomes are, and then choosing a path. And there's no 100% right answer. But the other thing, just basketball wise, how much is this going to diminish him if he comes, even if he's able to play on it? how much would it diminish his level of play? And what does that do for the Sixers' chances? I mean, you presume they could still beat Atlanta probably, but against Milwaukee or Brooklyn, I mean, sheesh.
Well, yeah. And so the two components there, the long-term component and the short-term. On the long-term, you mentioned Bynum, and that obviously didn't end too well. Some of these guys, whether it's coming back quickly from surgery or the, well, he can't hurt it any worse. I never understood. Yeah.
So he can't hurt it any worse was what I heard when Brandon Roy came back, you know, for that playoff game in Portland. And yeah. So, yeah, he can't hurt it any worse is a little red flaggy to me.
Well, particularly on a meniscus. And Blake Griffin in 2019 was another one of those. Never the same after that. And who knows? For some of these, you can never be sure, right? Like, it could just be he'd be compromised regardless of if he had just sat out and gotten the surgery and never tried to come back. Mo Harkless was another one of those guys who tried to come back really early from the surgery. But there's also probably a lot of these guys, too, who are playing on these that you just, you know, it never gets publicized or something like that too. You know, Jason Kidd was another one of those guys in, I think it was 04, who had the same issue. Bobby Marks was talking about that on Wind Horse Pod the other day. Yeah, it's a really difficult problem to me. I am, because, you know, flags fly forever. Given their bracket and the fact that they have home court throughout the East, I don't know that they will ever have a better chance than this. But this is not Andrew Bynum. All right, I'm just going to be a big body, start the game, run up and down, stand next to the rim, try to get some offensive rebounds. Like, they need to run their offense through this guy in every play.
He has to be the best player in the series for them to win it against Milwaukee or Brooklyn.
So, I think probably my plan would be, obviously in consultation with, you know, how he's doing on a day-to-day basis, is get it back, see if you can get it back to the point where he's not experiencing any pain and it's not swelling up really badly, you know, when he's doing workouts. And if you can get it to that point, throw him back out there and see how it feels after one game. And if he's not able to go out there and dominate, then fuck it, shut him down, because you're not going to win anyway at that point. Yeah. Like, if he's able to go out there and really be the guy, okay, then it's worth it. Then it's worth the risk to me. If he's just running up and down and he's going to be 6 out of 16 and not getting to the foul line and he can't move on defense and he's just out there.
Yeah, there's no point in that.
Yeah, he's just out there because he's still better than Dwight Howard, even in this compromised position. Yeah, then forget it, right? So, I mean, what a bummer this is, though, honestly. And
yeah,
it's just.
I'll point out one other thing. 4 years ago, the Sixers announced that Embiid had a minor meniscus and was day-to-day, and he didn't again the rest of the season and needing surgery.
Yeah, that was the Colangelo era. Not that Daryl.
Different.
Yeah, not that Daryl would ever be above obfuscating things for his own advantage as well in the media, by the way. Remember the Carmelo Anthony rant? Just for one example.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, honestly, like, if he can't play, though, I would probably actually favor the Hawks in the next round over them if he can't go at all. And maybe with the diminished Embiid and home court and the defense that they have, they could pull through. But like, Trae Young is not the guy I would want to be having to have Joel Embiid guard in pick and roll when he's coming off a knee injury.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is definitely a new wrinkle for Philly.
Or an old wrinkle, sadly.
Today
on the road to the finals, our NBA playoffs coverage is brought to you by, of course, Michelob Ultra. It's only worth it if you enjoy it. And at 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, we can all enjoy the games a little bit more this season. All right, so let's talk about the rest of the playoffs here. You know, we like to just kind of go through organized things. So let me ask you this here. Two questions. Who has been the best team so far? And who would be your championship pick now? Obviously, we did this last week, but we got new information now.
The best team has been the Milwaukee Bucks. My pick to win the championship is whoever wins the series between the Milwaukee Bucks and the Brooklyn Nets. And I change my mind every 5 minutes about who will win that series.
Yeah, that's well, let's talk about that series now. Actually, I haven't had a chance to really jump in on it too much. But you change your mind every 5 minutes about who will win that series. I think most people would favor Brooklyn. So why are you giving the Bucks more of a chance maybe than the consensus? So I will note that I'm largely in agreement with you on this being an all-time series.
I kind of liked how Milwaukee looked when they played Brooklyn head-to-head. Like, I just felt like they weren't overwhelmed playing against Brooklyn's offensive talent, and that Giannis was a really difficult matchup for the Nets, and that they could probably keep Brook Lopez on the floor a lot against them even. And, losing DiVincenzo, I think, hurts more than people realize because that bench is not deep. But I still think Milwaukee has to feel pretty good about this. Like, they don't end up in these matchups that some other teams match up against Brooklyn, where it's just like, okay, well, that's hopeless. Like, this particular player has no chance guarding Harden or Irving or whatever. Like, you're just not going to see them getting those kinds of matchups unless the Nets can put fouls on them.
Yeah, I would also say that the Jeff Green injury to me is huge. I think that actually hurts Brooklyn more than not having DiVincenzo hurts Milwaukee. And I think Connaughton, and maybe you can get away with one Forbes out there. We'll see. Just how Milwaukee is going to try to match up defensively and do it with Lopez is huge. Also worth noting, though, that Milwaukee never faced all three of the big three on Brooklyn. So that's
correct.
That's definitely worth noting. And Brooklyn still did beat them in that first game, which I think was probably the best analog for what this is going to look like. But how these teams guard each other, that is the big question to me of who the fuck is guarding Giannis on Milwaukee, right? I mean,
who on Brooklyn has a chance against Giannis? Who do they play DeAndre? Who, put him in this weird deep drop and try to bait Giannis into shooting threes. But then you're kind of taking a zero at the offensive end and you're letting Brook Lopez just hang out at the rim the whole game. If you play it that way, Jeff Green would probably be their most favored option, I would think, if everyone was at full strength, because he's big enough to take some shifts. Again, like, you could put him on Giannis, and if he gets fouls on him, it's not the end of the world. But also, he's able to play outside and open the lane for everybody, and that becomes a tough cover for Lopez. And so I would think he'd be the first choice. Like, I don't get super excited about Blake Griffin playing against them.
Put
Blake Griffin on Giannis.
Like, Giannis, like, they're just going to have to double team. I mean, I think that's the only way to do it, and just say, try to say, all right, whoever's guarding Giannis, your job is just to make Giannis make a spin move or a crossover, and then we're going to bring in the second guy as he's doing that move and try to draw an offensive foul or force him to pass it or something like that. I think we will see DeAndre. We'll just have to, because Nick Claxton, he's going to just get completely run through. He's way too thin. KD is way too thin.
Same thing with Durant. Yeah. Same thing with Durant,
100%.
Right?
Anytime KD is matched up against Giannis, Giannis has just gone right through him. Is Milwaukee still going to try and like switch and stay out of rotation? That's really interesting as well. I think the Nets now did do a pretty good job against the Celtics of keeping them away from the rim, but obviously the Bucks are a huge rim team. The offensive glass is going to be another thing. Milwaukee completely destroyed Miami on the offensive glass, with Lopez really was more just playing inside. But you also have this Brooklyn team. They just put up the best offensive rating in a series that we've seen like since the play-by-play started, essentially. And against a Boston team that's not like terrible defensively as well. And so if it turns into a three-point shooting contest, you gotta kind of like the Nets there a little bit. But just the question is, could the Milwaukee Bucks going up against this Nets defense, I can't think of a playoff defense on like a real contender that's this bad, right? Like, can you think of any? I mean, I guess you would have to go back to some of those Cleveland teams, but they had LeBron, when LeBron could at least turn it on.
Nash Nowitzki in Dallas would probably be the
one. Yeah, on the, but they at least still,
2002, 2003.
Yeah, and that was like a 61 win team. They were playing zone that year. They had like a big center at times as well. I can't remember. Was that Eric Dampier? Actually, that might have been, but that might have been before Dampier. That might have been the Rafe LaFrance era.
The LaFrance era, yeah, because they had the best offense of all time, like relative to the league, and they still like they only went like 50-32 or something and lost in the first round.
That was the last Nash year. I think they were playing Dirk at center more. The 03 year, they actually were reasonably decent on defense. I'm trying to think of who else. You know, some of those Suns teams maybe you could point to, but those teams were generally around league average, and they at least had Sean Marion, who was pretty good. Yeah. I mean, Amare and Nash. Yeah, Amare and Nash were terrible.
Yeah.
But, you know, Diaw was okay back when he was skinny for those teams. I would say those teams had a little more defensive talent. But, I haven't seen anything to indicate that this isn't the greatest offense of all time, though, right now. Like, I think they're better than the 17 Warriors because they have Joe Harris to put around these three guys as well.
That's the part that just kills it. Like, if you help at all, you're dead. Or, you know, if they run action with, you know, Harris coming off a pin down and Durant's the screener, like, you're not going to help, right? So Harris basically gets a wide open three. Like, they just have so many ways to score.
I imagine the Bucks are going to start off at least in like a drop coverage. Like they're not going to not start Lopez in game one. And maybe just if they can totally keep him off the rim and then just kill them at the rim, kill him in transition, kill him in the hustle stats, kill him on the boards, that could be enough. Get guys in foul trouble as well so that you don't have all three of those guys on the floor, kind of mess up their rotations a little bit. And this is, I can't remember a series I was this excited for in just,
Certainly in the second round. I mean, probably not since Lakers Spurs in 04, or was it 05? When Fisherman
shot. That was 04.
That's probably the last time we had a second round series of this magnitude. Yeah, or
Sun Spurs 07 would come to mind on that for me as well. Yeah, I mean, that was, those only happened because they messed up the seeding system for a few years.
Oh, yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, the Dallas San Antonio 06 series where Dirk got the 3-point play at the end
of
game seven.
Yeah, that was another unbelievable one, too. Like, oof. I mean, do you have a pick in that series? Have you not thought about it enough? I'm not ready to make none yet.
Oh, I've thought about it a lot. I've thought about it a lot. I'm just not sure I have a pick. I mean, Brooklyn has home court advantage, right? So you give them a little bit of an edge there. Green may be back at some point in the series. DiVincenzo is definitely out. Thanasis Antetokounmpo is out, and I actually think that may hurt a little. Like, he could really be an option against Durant.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I could see him getting three fouls in three possessions, potentially.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
No, I really think the loss of Green helps because who in crunch time now, who is your fifth guy if you're Brooklyn?
That's the thing I just haven't been able to get my head around. Like, do you go Bruce Brown? Do you go
probably Bruce Brown? But then he can't shoot. So now you like because you really not having the ability to go five out at the end of the game, I think, is a big problem for Brooklyn.
Do you play Shamit and just live with the carnage on defense?
Oh man, Shamit is so bad on defense. So,
and I mean, like, he can't dribble either, but that doesn't matter if you have Harden and Kyrie out there. But yeah, I mean, that's your floor spacing option.
I mean,
right?
I probably, like, you know, I would love to go with Claxton, but he's so inexperienced. And like, if Claxton just had like a little more strength, so you definitely don't go Blake Griffin. I mean, I think you got to just kind of cycle through these guys. And, you know, Jeff Green, really, like, what a loss it is to not have him. They also still have Spencer Dinwiddie on this team, too. Not that he's going to play, but, like, it's just they really are down some guys. Like, it is just Irving, Harden, and Durant and shooting. I mean, and Joe Harris. Like, you're kind of Tyler Johnson, like, to be kind of scrappy a little bit. Or, you know, do they dust off, like, TLC? Nice.
Look, TLC, I was going to ask about TLC. Like, they haven't gone to him, but could he be an option? Like, I, you know, Mike James, I don't really think he's an option. They're scraping the barrel here.
Because I think that's
for a
that's game. What it's going to come down to is like how much can they hurt Lopez, and maybe you can just do it enough with KD and Irving coming off of screens and just shooting that's enough, because Lopez is probably not going to get out on the floor in most of these situations. And you know, if you can get into that Bobby Portis underbelly, then that really helps. Does Milwaukee just switch everything with Tucker and Giannis? Do they try to go that route? That's really tough, though, because I came to this realization where you're like, okay, yeah, the only way you can beat these guys is to switch, right? Because you just can't get over it. Harden will just carve you up in a conventional pick and roll defense, and KD and Kyrie are just too good of shooters. But what I realized in that Celtics series, like, you know, they're always like, okay, well, we're going to tire this guy out by putting multiple defenders on him. What Brooklyn does is they tire out your shittiest defensive player by putting multiple offensive players on him, right? Like, so it's not Harden isolating on this guy every time. First, it's Evan Fournier has to guard Kyrie in an ISO. Then he has to guard KD in an ISO. Then he's got to guard Harden. So, like, those guys are all fresh while your shitty defender is getting even shittier because he's getting tired out.
On every play. Yeah. Yeah. That could be a problem. Yeah. I mean, especially like, you know, when they go to the bench, I mean, Connaughton, I think, is at a disadvantage, but when they go to Bryn Forbes, that's when it's really like, oh, okay. That's where Bryn Forbes and Landry Shamet are going to be really happy to see each other on the court, I think, this series.
Yeah, well, until one of them gets switched on to somebody else. So they're just, I do think that maybe Brooklyn has a little bit of a coaching advantage, but Bud did show a pretty good ability to change up in the Miami series, but that was obviously such a blowout that you didn't, other than game one, you didn't really get to see that too much. I mean, I do think that this series could be a series that has a lot of blowouts either way, going back and forth, but will also end up being close. Yeah. If I gun to my head right now, I would take the Brooklyn Nets just because they have so much talent and the offense is just so good. And I think we still don't quite understand how awesome that can be, but they are going to have times where they're going to struggle. Like, those guys are going to have to dig deep and just have like unbelievable offensive performances, because like Milwaukee is just going to score completely at will. And they're just, it's going to be the ultimate test of like size versus skill. But Milwaukee has a lot of skill too, and they have such a massive athleticism and size advantage. So Brooklyn, you think Brooklyn would be your pick too right now?
Home court advantage, I think, has to lean you toward defaulting Brooklyn unless you really strongly believe in Milwaukee. And I certainly won't be surprised if Milwaukee wins this series, but I would go like 60% Brooklyn, 40% Milwaukee.
Yeah, and I think also Brooklyn just at the end of games should be able to be just a little bit more organized offensively and have a few more things that they can go to. But I mean, like all three of those stars are going to have to play 40 minutes, like, and they're going to have to like actually physically be taxed on the defensive end.
Yeah, and not get injured. I think the one thing, like Brooklyn's frailty, I think, hasn't been discussed enough. Like Harden and Durant both had serious hamstring injuries this season, yeah, like fairly recently. And Kyrie Irving is Kyrie Irving. So the odds of all three of those guys making it through all seven games of, you know, basically in every other day format, they're going to be able to work in, I think, two off days in there, or extra off days, I should say, because they're starting early. But I mean, that's going to be taxing.
Another thing that's going to be a fascinating subplot is, where do you put Drew Holiday? I would actually say put him on Kyrie and just say, we're going to try and just totally take Kyrie out of the series. And then, you know, Drew, after he challenges his shot, can run down and get like a deep post up on him. Like, I think whoever, whether Kyrie or Drew Holiday, whoever outplays the other on that matchup this series, I think that could be go a long way towards determining who wins it.
Yeah, I think you put Holiday on Irving for a couple of reasons. First of all, Harden is better at drawing fouls, and so you kind of prefer to have Connaughton there, I think. And then Connaughton is really good at rear contests. So like the way they want to play, he probably has a better chance of bothering Harden's jump shot, maybe, when he comes around that. And even though you wouldn't necessarily choose to leave Pat Connaughton on an island one-on-one against James Harden. So I will take my chances.
Well, they could also put Middleton on Harden as well.
They could put Middleton on Harden and put Connaughton on the
Joe third, Harris.
On
yeah.
Harris. That's true too.
Yeah, because I think just your value added, like, I don't know that Drew can stop Harden, and because Harden likes to work in pick and roll. They're going to play a lot of conventional pick and roll defense. So that's going to be really interesting. And then, but Kyrie wants to ISO, and so I don't think he can ISO effectively against Drew Holiday. Whereas Harden likes to ISO some too, but I'm just more concerned about Kyrie's ISO game as a scorer than Harden necessarily. But it's a tough call. And then PJ Tucker, where is he going to come in? Also, you know, I think he guards KD pretty well. And do you go big with Lopez, Giannis, and Tucker out there? Would that put Tucker on, you know, I guess KD then maybe could guard someone on the perimeter and like be more of a help guy? We're going to see so many permutations. It's going to be awesome. You don't need me to tell you the benefits of locker room, because you're seeing it right here later in this podcast. You can jump in and ask us questions live. I've been just really impressed by the quality of the discourse on locker room. I've never even been sworn at. No, I'm kidding about that, obviously, but it's really, we get some great questions, really smart fans, just respectful, fun dialogue. Whether you want to just lurk it and listen live or jump in it with your own speaker requests, it's a ton of fun to do. John and I, of course, do this at 2 Eastern, 11 Pacific every Wednesday. Danny LaRue and I have our own locker room on Tuesdays at 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific before the games start. That's just an hour-long one that's only answering questions from speakers. So it's just a ton of fun. You can download their free app now. It's currently available on all iOS devices. They even have an Android beta as well. Follow me at Nate Duncan NBA. You can be notified when my room goes live. Locker room, changing the way we talk sport. If the last year has taught us anything, it's that we don't really need bricks and mortar stores anymore. Going to your local auto parts store really was not a good experience to begin with. In that front area, they never really had anything other than just totally generic stuff. And then you would go to that desk, you probably had to wait in line while the one person who was there at the counter tried to find the part that the person in front of you wanted. And then finally, when you got up there, you'd ask for your part and they'd say, oh yeah, we can order that. It'll be here in 2 weeks. Well, great. I could have just stayed at home and used rockauto.com, got my part faster, and saved a bunch of money. Chain stores at different price tiers for professional mechanics and do-it-yourselfers. rockauto.com's prices are the same for everybody and are reliably low. So go to rockauto.com right now, see all the parts available for your car and truck. You just put your make and model in there, right? Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box, so they know that we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need, rockauto.com. Okay, any other sort of thoughts, big picture wise? Maybe we'll turn to the West now. Obviously, things have changed since we last talked in that Clippers-Dallas series. But would you, you know, I think you and I, when we talked about it last week, we both had Utah going through and getting to the finals. Would you change that now?
I'm not sure I would. I still feel like we've seen enough warts from the Clippers to make me wonder about a series against Utah even.
Yeah, so you think you would favor Utah in that series?
I still think I would favor Utah. I think that'll be... That's another one that looks like a tough series, like easily could go seven games. But yeah, I think Utah's got some advantages there. I still think like when the Clippers play small, like I still think Utah can hurt that, even if they're switching everything. Just because, I mean, Gobert is just so big, like you're trying to keep him off the glass and... I don't know. I still see some problems with that for the Clippers.
Yeah, I think that could go either way. There was about 5 minutes of one game between those two teams this year where it was the Clippers went small against Gobert and they won it down the end, and that looked pretty good. So I don't want to overstate that, but also like I thought their process looked pretty good. But my bigger reason I think that I would actually as of right now favor the LA Clippers to come out of the West, and hey, I mean, they could still lose to the Mavericks, right? Like Utah's series is done.
Yeah.
But it's just that Kawhi Leonard looks like an absolute beast right now. Like he is getting back to being the player who he was, you know, in 2019, and he's getting to the rim and killing guys as well. Like that space, like there's no way to stop Kawhi Leonard for the Utah Jazz with the type of spacing that the Clippers can put out there. So I that's what I think it would come down to. I would probably pick that series as Clippers in six, but again, noting that it could easily go either way. You know, that's kind of a 55-45 series. And then the other bracket, we've got like the injury bracket.
Yeah,
it's just really hard for me to see either any of those four teams beating the winner of Utah and the Clippers, or you know, if maybe Dallas could still go through somehow. But I think they're kind of, seems like the Clippers have kind of figured them out a little bit.
Yeah,
but we'll find out tonight. This could be all obsolete again. That's what I love about this shit.
I would agree. I mean, Phoenix is probably the one that has the best chance. They beat Utah three times in the regular season.
Yeah, actually, Phoenix against Utah, I might actually. Are they ever going to be healthy? That's the question.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, Chris Paul looked good last night. I mean,
but
we'll
he re-injured it again,
you know,
right?
But is it, you know, I guess we just have to see how injured his re-injury is. Are you surprised they're playing Frank Kaminsky instead of Dario Saric?
No, I'm not surprised. Yes, I think it's a terrible move.
let me rephrase that. Do you agree with the decision to play Frank Kaminsky?
They're like matching him up with Gasol now, and in the first and third quarter, so that he's not just getting trucked right at the start of the fourth. But it's still, yeah, I don't really, I realize like they've kind of like lost confidence in Dario, but he's also like he's making $8 million a year for a reason, and Frank Kaminsky got cut by the King. Saric is a better passer. I think he's actually a better pick and roll offensive player, even though neither of them are amazing. And I like Saric better defensively, even.
And Saric is definitely better at making layups.
I mean, to me, if Paul, but like this Paul thing is massive. Like if he's the guy he was able to be the last two games before he got hurt again, you know, I think they can close the Lakers out in six. Because I don't think AD is going to be ready to play in game six based on the fact like
I'd be surprised.
Why would you be surprised?
Just, I mean, based on the nature of the injury and just, I mean, groin injuries aren't quick, but, you know, basically is how I would sum it up. So you can sort of feel kind of okay when you wake up in the morning, but once you try to do something, it's like right back. Or if he decides to try to play, he'll last like 3 minutes.
Yeah, I think my general rule of thumb is if you suffer a muscle injury that causes you to have to leave the game, you're going to be out for a week, if not more. And the hope kind of was, all right, he tweaked it a little bit. He's already got this knee sprain. Let's just not risk it and just let him heal up, because he just has too many kind of small things wrong with him. But then watching him in that film before the game, trying to do like a defensive slide, like a very light defensive slide. And like, he clearly, you could see from his face, he felt something when he tried to do that. Like that was not even like a real basketball movement. So like that, you don't heal up within 2 days from something that's causing you pain to even slide. Cause like when you were with Memphis, I mean, I know you're not a doctor, but like, do you kind of remember what like the return to play process was for guys with muscle injuries like that, of just like what benchmarks they'd have to go through and stuff?
Because you'd see him on the practice court first, so you'd know like, okay, he's getting close, and you'd see them progressing through different things with the training staff, and they were real basketball things, like they'd be actually sweating, right? It wasn't like take one step gingerly to your right. I would agree with your assessment. I'd be very surprised if he played again this series.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they'll try and throw him out there for a game seven if they get there. And LeBron, like, he came out last night in, like, takeover mode, but they got down early so quickly that I think he ended up throttling it down. He missed some shots early, then he hit some threes later in extended garbage time.
Yeah, really. The whole half of garbage time.
The
best thing that happened to the Lakers was that Portland-Denver game.
All right, we got about 15 minutes left here. Any coaching moves that have really stood out to you in this first round?
Coaching moves that stood out to me.
Well, last night, obviously, right? Well,
I mean, there was a lot going on in that. Yeah, there was a lot going on in that Denver-Portland game last night. The decision to foul up three or not foul up three, I think, is much less ironclad than people realize. I mean, we study this a lot, and other teams have too. And there's a reason that you don't see it executed universally, because there's there's more downside to it than people commonly assume. And your position is more favorable as a team up three than people think, too. Even though Lillard was able to tie the game, obviously, yeah. these two instances against Denver. But preceded, by the way, by one of the worst calls you will ever see in the last minute of the game.
You're talking about the foul on Lillard? No, that was 100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was, okay. It was possibly an arm bar on Rivers, but granting the three shots was absurd. Okay,
so everyone, I thought everyone missed this. Rivers makes contact, like he didn't make any body contact, right? Like that's because that's what everyone's looking for in that situation. Like that's typically what it is, like the arm bar on the body.
Mm-hmm.
Dame is dribbling with his left hand. He goes to pick the ball up, moving his right hand towards the ball to shoot it. And Rivers hits his right hand as he's bringing it to the ball. That's where the contact took place that I think a lot of people might have missed. And okay. that's why Dame had to kind of do that. Like, because as you're trying to bring your hand to the ball, then you're going to start your jump at the same time. And because he couldn't grab the ball as quickly, that's why he had to kind of like grab it lower and then like double pump and shoot. So, for people who say that's not a foul, I mean, I think people just didn't see that like his hand got deflected as he was trying to bring it to the ball. I thought it was super close though on whether it was a shooting foul or not, because he's bringing his hand to the ball. Like that is that not part of the shooting motion? I mean, the way they have called it is to make it kind of default a non-shooting foul. So I think I probably would have made it a non-shooting foul, but
yeah,
man, it was close. I thought, but no, I mean, that's a lot of people had the same take that you did, but I thought that people were just missing that part of it, because if someone hits your arm as you're trying to go grab the ball to shoot it,
yeah, that's a foul. That's the Lou Williams special. And so if I missed that, then that would be a common foul, as they say. I think all fouls are special and should be, you know, regarded in their own way. But I don't think calling them common fouls is good for their self-esteem.
That's what John Goble.
But that's another story for another day.
He thinks that all fouls should be trumpeted in their own right. Well, I guess what you can say is, you know, certainly when like Dame got inside the arc and after he had already made a ridiculous one, they probably should have fouled. They also have a really good rebounding team, you know, if they're going to intentionally miss the free throw. But part of maybe why you don't foul, it was illustrated by the fact that, hey, they ended up winning, right? Like, even if they tie the game, you still have a 50% chance of winning. They're at home. The Nurkic has fouled out. They're outplaying them. I mean, even after Dame tied it after the second OT, I was like, I like Denver here because Nurkic has fouled out. They can't stop him. I mean, I thought Stotts had some foibles too. Like, putting the skinniest guy that you have on Jokic rather than the stouter guy, which is Carmelo, if you're going to go small, that was a little weird.
Yeah. You want to put Carmelo on him, because then Covington's a help defender rather than Carmelo being a non-help defender, right? And then you're not putting fouls on Covington either. And, you know, the other thing Stotts did, he took that timeout right after the Porter three, and I think he would have liked to have it later. I'm not sure it would have mattered anyway, but they ended up driving the ball up with like 17 seconds left. They really could have used that timeout there.
Yeah, maybe so. I talked about it pretty extensively on Dunked On Prime, but yeah, I mean, there are a lot of interesting coaching things, like putting Michael Porter Jr. back in the game to guard Dame at the end of regulation. He wasn't supposed to guard Dame, right? There's no reason he or Jokic should have been in at that point.
He took them out when Portland called the timeout to inbound the ball. And then after one play that took 3 seconds and the replay review, he put them back in to defend basically the same thing. Like, I don't understand what happened there.
Really, really odd. Any other series, any other kind of moves, coaching things that have stood out to you? I guess the one thing for me is just Frank Vogel is just desperately searching for anything right now in his rotation.
I'm surprised they haven't turned to Montrezl Harrell, actually. Like, they can't score. So I know they're going at him in pick and roll, but frankly, I mean, they're going at Marc Gasol and Andre Drummond too. And I just wonder if they're going to end up getting more out of this if they end up just, especially in the non-LeBron minutes. Like, I think you just have to have Harrell out there. You're just never going to score.
And I mean, Schroeder has been so awful. He's 3 of 22 in the last two games, 0 of 9 in this game. when they basically like brought him in to be the second perimeter scorer, and maybe the Schroeder and Harrell pick and roll could help, but they haven't really gone to that much this whole season. The other thing I thought, I'm not sure that Harrell is a great option, because it's kind of been a defensive series, and I think, like, to me, if you're gonna win, you play unbelievable defense and get like just enough offense, and I'm not sure that Harrell, I mean, maybe you'd try him, but like Kuzma to me is a guy who is just, how it is that they're not like trying to make him more of a scorer and like running like ISO plays for him. Like, yeah, that's not efficient offense. You know, he's like 54% true shooting back when he was actually a guy who was asked to score a lot. But if you've got, he's going to have a good matchup if you started him, because you would have Schroeder and LeBron being guarded by Bridges and Crowder. So he can go at, you know, a Devin Booker or Chris Paul and you get him into that mid post, let him go to work. Like, he's not going to kill the Suns, but he'll at least give you better than, you know, a 90 offensive rating, or at least, you know, at least it's something to try, right? I think it's, yeah. But they've kind of like turned him into this weird like defender hybrid role player guy. So I don't know. They got to find something, some way to score tonight though. And maybe, or I'm sorry, tomorrow night. That's LeBron being a little bit better. They can't hit a three. That's the other problem. Like, that's another reason I think, you know, having like that kind of mid post ISO game would be nice, because you don't need as much spacing for that. But yeah, they could be in trouble here, and they got to maybe kind of hope that Chris Paul is not 100%, or I think they're going home.
And I mean, and honestly, like, Cameron Payne's been better than Chris Paul in a couple of these games too.
Yeah,
you know, that like their problems are deeper than just Chris Paul.
No, I think you're right about that. Yeah, the East haven't really had any big like coaching stuff at all. Memphis, Utah, I think has kind of played out the way we thought it would, which is the Jazz 3-point shooting being too much. And
yeah, the Grizzlies just can't get the stops against them. I'm a little surprised they haven't at least tried to play Tillman instead of Valanciunas, and kind of change up how they're defending a little bit. But I'm not sure it'll matter. They may not. They may just, at that point, without Valanciunas, they may just not be able to score enough at the other end. But, you know, good on the Grizzlies still. You know, it's been fun for me to watch. You know, Kyle Anderson's had, you know, all those steals in the first game. Dylan Brooks has been tremendous. Jaren Jackson, these last two games, I think has been better, which is a good sign heading into next year. So that part's been really fun for me to watch. But yeah, I think it ends tonight.
No, it seems like that's probably the case. But yeah, and I think for Memphis, it's just been, I think it's good for them to have this experience and kind of realize that if they really want to go deep, they're going to need to restructure their team a little bit. I mean, you're not going to be able, with Jonas Valanciunas on the floor, as important as he's been to their success and as good as he was during the regular season, you just can't defend well enough with just a conventional pick and roll scheme with Jonas Valanciunas against like a good playoff offense. Like, they need to, in terms of building their team, if they really want to go deep, and maybe that's just not going to happen and they got time with Ja, but they got to figure out some more defensive versatility. And a lot of times too, that comes, yeah,
they need another big wing too. You know, Winslow being unplayable, I think, has really hurt the rotation this series. You look out there,
at least, like, is he just so bad that they can't even give him like 1 minute out there?
It was pretty rough. you do wonder that, sure. Or if not him, John Conchar, maybe, who's at least a little bigger. But there, you look out there and there's, you know, 4'6" guys out there sometimes, and it's just hard for them to deal with it. And also, like, Morant not being good on defense, I think, has hurt them too, because what happens when they play those smaller lineups is Brooks is basically forced to guard Bogdanović, because Bogdanović will beast anyone else. So then that leaves Grayson Allen on Donovan Mitchell, and that's where things go off the rails, right?
Yeah, but they can't score well enough. And if you're going to play Jaren at the four, then you're forcing Ja to guard Mike Conley as well. So that, yeah, I mean, they're and obviously Jaren Jackson Jr. becoming like a switchable five who can bomb it from all over the place solves a lot of their problems, and then they can get a few more wings in, and then maybe they're really cooking. But Jaren is a ways from being that player if it's ever going to happen. You know, I mean, I think I don't want to put him in our most disappointing players category necessarily, because he is coming back from the injury, but like he can't have these ridiculous fouls. He's got to move his feet better, and like his shooting's going to come back around again. Like, I'm not worried about that part of it. I think he's going to be solid again offensively, but just getting to where they've tried playing him at center some in this series, it's been mixed results.
I actually think his minutes backup this series. Yeah. Did fine, but it's different playing backup 5 minutes versus playing starting 5 minutes. Like, he's not going to be able to play as a starting five for at least a while. He has to get stronger and figure out how to foul less. And he's rebounding a little more in this series, which is encouraging, but the rebounding is obviously way substandard.
I mean, he just never boxes out ever. He doesn't, like, his ass never makes contact with an opposing player.
Or when he does try to box out, he ends up face guarding and just holding the guy. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, face guarding is just, I don't know why anybody ever tries that. Like, that's just an easy recipe for a foul. Any other players that's really stuck out to you? We got like 3 minutes left here before we're going to move on to some of these speaker requests in locker room.
It's just funny watching this Denver backcourt of just like random guys in this series. Austin Rivers, who they picked up off the street, is now guarding Damian Lillard in crunch time. And I mean, good on them. Like, they've made the most out of it. Like, Campazzo's actually been fairly good in some of these games, but it's kind of amazing. And somehow Monty Morris isn't starting ahead of these guys. That's the other thing that's kind of wild, but they're making it work. And if, you know, they can get to the second round and get Will Barton back, maybe then maybe they have a chance at winning the next round too.
The two big variables to me are Denver's 3-point shooting, which, I mean, obviously they're getting wide open looks because they're so concerned about Jokic. But, you know, when Denver is shooting over 40% from three in this series, they win games. And when they don't, they don't look so hot. And then the other thing is just the Nurkic foul trouble. Like, when he's on the floor, Portland wins those minutes. So it's just, how much does he end up playing? If you're hiring for your company, what you need is help making your short list of quality candidates. You don't need 500 candidates who just applied with no regard for what the actual qualifications are. You need Indeed instead. You can post, screen, and interview all on Indeed. You can also use skill tests to winnow down the field of applicants. And using Indeed overall will, on average, reduce the amount of time you spend on hiring by 27%. You only pay for the candidates that meet your must-have qualifications, and you can schedule and complete video interviews in your Indeed dashboard. They've got over 130 skills tests, or you can even add your own. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined. So you're getting the high-quality candidates, you're saving time, and ultimately, getting the applicants that are right for you. Get started right now with a free $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at indeed.com/locked, the name of this network. Get a $75 credit at indeed.com/locked. Indeed.com/locked. Offer valid through June 30th. Terms and conditions apply. Most protein bars are awful. I like to work out. I've tried basically all of them. And before Built Bar, I'd resigned myself to the idea that they're all going to taste like a rock quarry. But now, with 18 amazing flavors, the improved Built Bar is even more delicious. There's 6 new flavors: caramel brownie, cookies and cream, cherry barcia, lemon almond cheesecake, carrot cake, apple almond crisp. Of course, there are classics like raspberry, peanut butter, double chocolate, peanut butter brownie. The bars are covered in 100% chocolate. That makes a huge difference. By the way, they're soft and easy to chew, but they're still great for the health conscious person. For example, peanut butter, 19 grams of protein, 180 calories, 5 grams of sugar, 5 grams of net carbs. Great for a keto diet. And you can even get a free cooler with purchase while supplies last. Go to builtbar.com, use the promo code LOCKED15, and you'll get 15% off your next order. Use promo code LOCKED15 for 15% off at builtbar.com. All right, well, that was fun here, but we got some speaker requests here for the next 20 minutes or so. Hopefully everyone is still around. We're going to start with Alan, and just say hi, Alan. You don't have to ask if we can hear you. Let's get rolling. All right, we'll try and jump back in, Alan. Let's get to Mike here. Mike Jorbzy, you are on. How you doing, Mike?
Hey, how's it going? So I'm a Sixers fan. Talk me off a ledge here a little bit, because I'm thinking like it's time for Process 2.0. Ultimately, like, it doesn't seem like Embiid's ever going to stay healthy. Simmons is pretty disappointing. Harris is pretty blah. I know they're the one seed, but it doesn't even seem like they're a true one seed, if we're being honest. It's the whole thing seems pretty bleak.
All right, let me try to talk you off the ledge here. So, and this injury for Embiid should not be a career alter. altering one. Okay. So whatever happens this year, he should be fine when they show up for training camp next year, unless the Sixers royally screw this up. Okay. Second thing is, like, you're still in position to maybe make some additions from here, or have some pieces that make the team better next year. And I'm not just talking about Paul Reed here. But you're only out one future first, right? And it's not till 25. And so you have the ability to make some deals here and push some more chips in. I think Hill's contract could potentially be interesting for that. They have some smaller numbers here. And then when you look at like Maxey, Tybull, like they have young guys coming up, which most teams in their position do not. So I think they can still be better than what they are now.
Yeah. Did he at least get you to a ledge on a lower floor with that?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely see the potential of a lot of the younger players. It's just more like the basic building block of the whole thing is Embiid. And like, it just seems like it's not even that it's uncertain. It's certain. It's just not certain. It's certain he's going to be injured when the playoff time comes around. So
he was healthy the last two playoffs, wasn't he?
He was healthy in 2020, not in 2019. He had like,
was that 2018?
Yeah, but he had the broken face that year that kind of prevented him from getting back in. Although that one at least was just a freak injury. Doesn't necessarily go into injury prone. So my working assumption, Mike, is that there's about a 50% chance that he'll be injured in some fashion during the playoffs. So and also, I mean, he's a really fun guy to watch. You know, I mean, it's got to be rough, though, as a fan, you know, having gone through this as a Bulls fan with Derrick Rose before I renounced my fandom. It was definitely really tough after that first injury to just always be fearing that like something was going to happen. So I do sympathize with you. The other thing John didn't mention, though, is the possibility of trading Ben Simmons. I think that's something that they can look into and try to get some more ball handling, reduce the offensive load on Embiid until the playoffs come along. That's something Embiid could also lose 40 pounds. That might help him a little bit. Like, he's definitely, you know, try to get back to the level of athleticism that he had before, just reduce the pounding. Like, he's having that weight might actually help his game in some ways, but it could also, you know, I would like to see him like getting back to being, you know, looking more athletic. So maybe that's a possibility. I don't know. It's definitely, but it, like, you're, that's just what it is for most teams, right? Like, I think the Sixers at least have like somewhat of a chance. You also have a great general manager now, which you didn't have before. So I wouldn't be, it's obviously discouraging, but I wouldn't say that they're just like totally drawing dead going into the future here. So thanks for that, Mike. And let us now get to Kadar, you are on with us here. Or are you, Kadar? All right, jump back in if you get a chance, Kadar. Let's get to Sergio. Sergio, you are on. You are muted right now, and now you aren't. How are you doing, Sergio?
Hi. Hello from Portugal. I have a question for you. I see these playoffs as an open field, and many teams with a real chance to win everything. Is there a possible matchup-wise NBA final that ends in a sweep, in your opinion?
Probably have to have an injury to get a sweep this year, I would think, because I think it's just really competitive. I think most of these potential finals matchups, you're looking at 6-7 games.
I think it's possible that Utah-Brooklyn could be a sweep. I think like Brooklyn could just overwhelm them. I think that's a possibility. But probably not, though. I'm mostly in agreement with John, but like if you said, what is the one matchup that I think would be a big problem for Utah, that's probably the one that would stick out to me. Because Brooklyn is still going to switch, which, you know, I think they could slow down Utah just enough. And Utah, like, I mean, they just have to play conventional pick and roll defense against Brooklyn, which Brooklyn is just going to murder that. So that's the one that sticks out to me. But I think Utah would win at least a game or two in that series. Thanks for that question. And it looks like we got Kadar back in. Kadar, are you there now? Kadar, you jump back in. Come on, we can do it. I will give him like 15 more seconds here. This silence will get edited out on the podcast. Yeah, we're here. How are you doing, Kadar?
Can you hear me? Oh, good. Sorry about that. I wanted to just ask about a general question in the playoffs, where some things that I've been noticing maybe for the last like few years, where, I mean, I guess it's been talked about all over the place, but it just seems like all these fives are just getting like basically taken off of the floor. They're being played off the floor. And so now I guess the general question is like, is it even worth drafting big dudes in the lottery anymore? Because you just know that all these plotting fives are just never gonna play in a closing five for you, because
it's that and that the replacement center is higher than other positions.
Yeah, I mean,
like it's not that hard to find center. This is an argument that I've had going back to before I worked in the media, let's just say. Is it worth it to draft centers, and especially centers who are not sort of elite talents? Now, on the other hand, you can flip that over and argue, well, if you can get Nikola Jokic or Marc Gasol in the second round, then hell yeah, it's worth it to draft a center. But I think, you know, especially when you're near the top, you know, top 10 picks or whatever, like you're really trying to hit on wing talent first, because that's the thing that drives everything when you start looking at playoff matchups, is having these guys between 6'5 and 6'8 who can defend multiple positions and handle the ball and create shots for themselves. Like if you got that, you are so far ahead of the game. And so to me, those are the players with the chance to be that type of player should almost always be the ones that come off the board first. Unless there is some exceptional reason to take a player at a different spot.
The Warriors are looking to hire for their front office. You think you could jump in there?
Well, I mean, that would be fantastic. I do have a pretty big job in Toronto, but I would definitely take that job if it was offered. I guess the other question would be that, you know, I mean, the Clippers and Jazz second round is going to be really interesting to see whether or not Gobert is actually going to even play. Well, is he going to play?
Oh, he will. But, yeah, 100%.
Like, oh, he will.
Absolutely. Yeah. They can hide him on Rondo. Like, they can put him on Marcus Morris. I mean, they'll probably give up some corner threes potentially. But no, I mean, Utah will, I guarantee you, even with that issue, that Utah would be worse if, I mean, first of all, they don't even have a four, like a normal four on their team who could like switch and stuff and be athletic. So there's like their whole defense is predicated around Gobert closing off the rim. Yeah, we'll give up some shots from the outside, but we're going to try and at least force you inside the arc. And then, you know, he's got to run pick and roll on the other end too. So it's, he's a great, great player, but you know, you do make a good point. I don't know that he's as valuable in certain playoff matchups, and those are the matchups that he has to face. Thanks for that, Kadar. And now let us get to Nico. Nico, you're on with John and me.
I was just wondering, there's all the talk about the Celtics today and watching the Mavs in the playoffs. Do you think there's any feasibility to a potential Porzingis Kemba swap, like getting the Mavs off the money a year earlier, and then Porzingis might have some more value in a system like Boston?
I can't really see that one happening. The thing I thought you were going to say regarding Dallas is, could we see a Rick Carlisle Celtics reunion?
It'd be crazy.
Yeah, I don't think that would surprise me. It seems like he's pretty interested. Do you feel like his tenure in Dallas is like growing stale or something, John?
I guess I wouldn't be shocked if things went in a different direction there, let's say.
That's very interesting. Not having heard anything, but I can at least see why that would be the case. And honestly, like, there are some things that they could be doing better too, like never ever running a fast break is like a little bit of a problem for this team. But yeah, you know, it seems like Porzingis has been very frustrated there, and you know, I'm not sure when you have a star like Luka. I'm not saying I know anything about him being upset with Carlisle, but if you have a star of that level that the team is all in on, if that player decides he wants you to go in another direction at coach, it will happen. So there at least is just like a general kind of formula for that. And, Rick could be a little ornery at times. I've even experienced that myself once. That was an interesting digression there. Yeah, Porzingis, I would rather have Kemba than Porzingis personally. Going back to Nico's original question there, because A, the contract ends quicker, and the same structural stuff that we're talking about with Kadar's question last time is the case with Porzingis, right? Like Kristaps Porzingis, all right, he can't guard Joel Embiid. He is completely drawing dead in any kind of a series against Brooklyn. That's a team that you're trying to beat. You know, maybe he's a little bit better in a Milwaukee series, but those are the three teams you got to come up with. Like, he's just way too slow defensively at this point. Like, the Clippers are absolutely cooking him. So I think, like, he causes too many problems for the structure of your team, even if you might want to say, all right, he's going to give us more like raw production or whatever than Kemba. And he might even be in a bigger injury risk than Kemba as well. So thanks for that one, Nico. Appreciate that. And let's get to Nets World. Nets World. It is the Nets World right now.
How's it going, guys? Coming off the Joel Embiid news earlier today, it got me thinking about the way we talk about injuries in sports, or like in the context of them. So my question is, do you feel like we give enough attention to acknowledging how injuries have affected, you know, teams' performances or winning? Because, for example, a team like the Rockets this year, you know, everybody just says, LOL, the Rockets are bad because they traded Harden, and ignore the fact that so many of their best players were injured for much of the year, where their record would have been much better. And if the Sixers go on to lose to the Hawks, I feel like people, you know, obviously right now we'll say it, but in a few years, everybody's just going to say, oh, the Hawks upset the Sixers, and ignore the fact that, well, they didn't have Embiid. So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I mean, I think people are more cognizant of playoff injuries, actually. Like, people don't say, oh, the Sixers upset the Bulls, right, in 2012 or whenever it was. Was it 2012, Nate?
Yes, it was.
Sorry to trigger you here. Okay. So I think there's more awareness of like major postseason injuries like that. I think the ones that are hard are like, we lost in six and our third and sixth best players were injured. I think fans don't really forgive those, but I think those injuries kind of are more realized sometimes. And I think where the narrative can kind of lose sight of things. But if Embiid's out next round, nobody's going to be like, oh my God, the Hawks beat the Sixers. I wonder how that happened. And like, even years from now, I mean, people will be like, oh yeah, that was a series Embiid was out, and like sort of discount
it. To me, I think, yeah, you hit on a good point there that, you know, it's not, all right, their best player didn't play in the series. It's either your best player was really limited and you never know. Guys don't like to talk about injuries. You never know how limited the guy is. You don't want to take credit away for the other team for slowing him down. You know, the Steph Curry 2016 type of thing. Or there's just, all right, your third best guy just was out, you know, and then you just were forced to play these guys who, you know, you didn't have good depth and you ended up losing, right? So I think those, but I did a whole podcast on this once about 4 years ago, where Danny and I went through and looked at the injuries that kind of changed history, you know, that people just forget about. And so like for example, one that you might talk about is like Kevin Durant breaking his foot in 2015, right? Like, no one ever really talks about that anymore, about like how that may have hastened his exit eventually from Oklahoma City, and how that was one of the big chances that could have probably been their best team. A lot of people were picking them. So like, those are sort of the ones that, like, the ones that happened during the season, and then it's just like, all right, this guy just isn't available for the playoffs and this team just isn't good. You know, people kind of forget about those a lot too. So yeah, I think it does kind of get lost to history if it's not just like the super obvious, all right, your star didn't play and you got swept or something like that. All right, we got time for, we'll try to get two more here. Yeah, in the comments, Noah, Tim Duncan in 2000. That's like a perfect example of that. All right, let's see here. Give me some more speaker requests. Let's go with Chester. Chester, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I wanted to ask, what do you think would happen if the 2019 Raptors were in this playoffs, say like up against Philly as they were then, and Embiid wasn't injured? How do you think they'd match up with Philly? Would they be the favorites in the East? How would they match up with the other two teams?
I think they'd match up better because Jimmy Butler isn't there, and he was the Sixers' best player in that series. Or for stretch, I shouldn't say that. Embiid was really good too, but he was sort of their go-to guy in the half court for a lot of that series. I mean, Philly has more shooting right now, and it would be interesting to see Danny Green match up against Danny Green. But I still think I would take.
Yeah, I think I would. I think Gasol is one of the few guys. Embiid is better now than he was then, but Gasol really kind of locked him down in that series. Even though the plus minus was really good for Embiid in that series, you know, he really didn't have many great scoring games. I think Gasol could slow him down pretty well. And also, I mean, the other guys just flying around. You know, would Ben Simmons be able to do a better job on Kawhi Leonard now than he did back then? Maybe. But I also would expect that Toronto team to shoot a lot better. That's part of why I picked them the next series against the Bucks, was because I think everyone was really down on them because they just couldn't hit a three in that series. I think if you reran that series, it'd be better. I mean, now Toronto, that Toronto team against this Milwaukee team or against this Brooklyn team, that Toronto team guarding this Brooklyn team would be amazing. Like, I actually think that Toronto team is going to go down as one of the more underrated champions of the last 20 years because of the fact that, you know, the Warriors ended up getting injured against them and they only were together for 1 year. So they kind of didn't really have a chance to solidify in our memories. But I thought that was just a wonderful mm-hmm. defensive team. Like, that is one of the best playoff defenses that I've ever seen. That was just a great, great team.
Although I will say,
they almost even lost.
They won that series battlebound with Embiid missing one of the games.
Yeah, and they barely beat the Bucks in the next round too. So, I mean, that was just an epic Eastern Conference playoffs that year. But, you know, I do think that their shooting luck was just really bad in that Philly series. And I think that if they had just shot it, mean, because you saw the way they shot in the next series, if they just shot that way in the Philly series, I think they would have won that a little bit more comfortably, perhaps. Not that that Philly team wasn't really, really good also. Okay, we got a chance for one more here. And let's get to Angel here, if that's how you pronounce it. How you doing, Angel?
And John, I have a question. So Luka's shooting splits are 48.6 field goal, 40.9 3-point, and 40.6 free throws. Have we ever seen anything like this? Him struggling from the free throw line.
This is,
and can we explain it?
Yeah, it's the Bruce Bowen, right? I mean, the Clippers actually need to start talking about whether Haka Luka makes sense in some situations, because I think, you know, not only the percentages are what they are, but when you start screwing with his head a little, like, I think you maybe get an edge there. So I think that's a really interesting discussion. The Dallas free throw thing has been fascinating, because those first two games, and they were absolutely cooking the Clippers in every other respect, they were leaving so much money at the table at the free throw line. And I'm not really sure what's going on with Luka's free throw. I mean, I wonder if for some reason that, you know, thing in his neck is affecting his free throw more than his shooting on the move. But it's really bizarre, right, to see somebody who can shoot so easily from other situations just struggle so badly at the free throw line. Like, Bruce Bowen is the only other guy I can think of.
Well, and Bruce Bowen, you know, he was just so low volume from the free throw line. And he also wasn't a natural shooter, right? Like, he would take three corner threes a game or whatever. And also, like, usually when they'd go to the hack of Bowen, he would just start to hit him. It was just kind of more of he got fouled so rarely, I think. Whereas, like, a guy shooting threes on this type of volume, I mean, the only other one that comes to mind for me would be kind of what Russell Westbrook has gone through the last couple of years. Not that he was ever a great shooter, but he could at least hit mid-rangers okay, and he was at one point like an 80% foul shooter. Andre Iguodala maybe would be another one where he was a good foul shooter earlier in his career and then didn't go there as much and was kind of scared to get fouled late in his career. But a guy with this type of volume in the same series shooting as well from three, I can't ever remember anything like that happening. Now, if I tried the hack, I think I would do it like, you know, let's just do it once a quarter as opposed to just continually doing it, because then he could like get into a rhythm. You kind of want to just, but I think I would just play him straight up and just feel like, hey, you know what, like, if he beats us, then we've always got the option of fouling him and hoping that he makes some free throws. So maybe you just say, hey, if you're beat, we're gonna just foul you, we'll be more liable to foul you potentially, rather than going to like a straight hacka. But I think that would be the way I would approach it,
right? Or if the Mavericks ever ran a fast break, you could take a euro foul, right, and do the same thing.
Yeah, really. Okay, well, thanks for that one, and thanks so much for listening here. Want to remind everyone that Danny and I are actually calling games live on this new app called Hot Mic. You basically just fire up the app, and you can sync our commentary with your TV. It listens to your TV, and then we just basically become your announcers once it syncs up. It's really incredible technology. We're doing Clippers Dallas tonight, and we'll definitely be doing some of those games on Saturday as well, whether it's Nets Bucks game one or one of the game sevens also. So really looking forward to doing that. Have a bunch of people joining us on Hot Mic. And John, what have you been writing about lately for The Athletic?
Yeah, I wrote about the postmortem on the Miami and Boston Eastern Conference finalists last year, and only won one playoff game between them this year, and where they can go from here, how they got in this mess. Did a little something this morning on the news out of Boston as well. And before we go, I do want to have one somber note here. RIP to Rick Bonnell, the longtime Charlotte Hornets beat writer who passed away last night, I guess, was really a wonderful and enthusiastic, friendly, helpful guy to everyone on the beat, and obviously had more institutional knowledge about that team than anyone on the planet. So a big loss for the NBA community, and we're sorry to lose him.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.